The French satellite operator Eutelsat has notified Press TV of a plan to take the English language news network off the air. This comes weeks after the European Union imposed sanctions on the channel, along with a number of Press TV staff for alleged rights violations and how Iran countered the foreign-backed riots. Now, while this is another blow to the freedom of expression and alternative news, it also shows that the West, in particular the U.S., is continuing its maximum pressure campaign, a policy which is doomed to fail and has failed up to this point. Well, first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us in the studio is Marzia Hashemi, host of Press TV's Hidden Files. And we also have Feroz Al-Najim, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Welcome, Marzia. Welcome, Firas. I'll start with you, Marzia, taking a look at this warning at this point from Eutelsat.
Right.
It needs to be mentioned that it's a French satellite operator, and based on what we have is that it has notified Press TV of a plan to take the English language news network off the air. And this comes a few weeks after the European Union imposed some sanctions on Press TV and some of its personnel. What do you think about what Eutelsat has done?
I wish I could say I'm surprised, but I'm not covered. We have seen so many actions against Press TV over the years, and so many sanctions. And of course, we know even taking us out from our .com site. This is nothing new. This is nothing new. But again, as I always say, I believe that it shows that we are effective. But isn't it amazing, and doesn't it show the hypocrisy of it all, that in the middle, of course, of this hybrid war, that these Western powers and Israeli regime and the Saudis are involved in against Iran, and all the lies that we have seen by these various media stations in Farsi and in English, nothing happens to these entities for lying, outright lying. But then Press TV, the only English station in Iran, 24-hour news station representing Iran, is sanctioned time and time again. And now they're threatening to take us off another satellite. Again, not surprising, but I hope it encourages us even more to keep on doing what we're doing.
It sure will. It has up to this point. First of all, Najim, so Marzia Hashemi talks about how you have these other stations like the Saudi-funded Iran International or the BBC state broadcaster, the Persian language version. They actually are coming out with lies, half-truths, and exaggerations, if I can describe it that way. There are other words to describe it. Nothing happens to them. Of course, the question comes about, where is Ofcom? But then we have here Press TV that's doing what it can do, and yet it's being not only from the past to been taken off other satellites, but now Eutelsat coming out with this warning. It's a case of double standards, obviously, isn't it?
Yes, it's very obvious. Obviously, it's, you know, they're hypocrites, these regimes, and they're pushing the sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran because they're very effective, as Marzia Hashemi said. The more effective you are, the more they'll put, you know, embargoes and sanctions and try to defame you. And that's what Press TV is. It's a voice of the free people, of the oppressed people. It's a resistance voice, and it gives a chance, an opportunity for anybody in the world, you know, to speak out against all these atrocities, these human rights violations, this double standard work that's happening, you know, the United Nations silence on all these crimes that are happening in different places like Palestine, Yemen. things like that. And they don't like that. They don't like being exposed. They don't like being unmasked. And this is what Press TV does. It unmasks these different channels. You know, it fights the mainstream narratives. The public opinion is being challenged, and this is what Press TV is doing. And have they ever asked me to follow a certain narrative or give me any advice or anything? Never. It's been transparent. I've been freely expressing my opinion here, and you know, and they're just trying to silence the voice of the oppressed people and of the resistance. And they're failing miserably. This also exposes how they're violating their own, supposedly their own ethics that they claim that they have a freedom of expression and freedom of media and press and so on. They're not even giving their opposition, you know, as they claim that Iran is their opposition and they're against the Iranian government, they're not even giving them a chance to express their opinion and to speak out and to, you know, give present their case. And this is very unfortunate. It shows that they're a dictatorship. They're not a so-called democracy.
Okay. Well, let's break this down a little bit. We're going to get into the freedom of expression and all that issues related to that a little bit later on down. But, you know, this comes after the EU imposed sanctions on Press TV, and then you have this happening. Now, the EU has been very vocal. The European Parliament has been very vocal based on the rioting that has occurred, which you called it a hybrid war. Why have they been so vocal?
Well, I think they're giving it all they have this time around. You know, Kaveh, this is nothing new. These moves against the Islamic Republic, I can tell you, from 43 years from the time of the revolution. And to be honest, I mean, actually, even prior to that, there were certain things that they did against Iran in general, questioning its sovereignty. But for sure, from the revolution on, we have seen time and time again these type of moves to basically their goal is, as they call it, regime change, to overthrow the Islamic Republic. And I believe that they see the situation as far as the advancement of Iran. We have seen so many in various scientific fields, in the military area, so many areas of expertise that Iran is doing so well. And I think that they see it as a point that we have to give it all we have now, especially as this transition of power going from the West to East is taking place. And they see these new alliances, for example, with Iran, with Russia, with China, and with other countries, neighboring countries. So they are giving it all they have this time around. And we have seen, over the years, being at Press TV, we have seen various attacks and during these various situations have taken place. But really, for me, I know this time around, it was so multifaceted and still is. They threw everything they had at Iran this time around. So that's why you're seeing this activity with the European Union, with all of them. And even though the situation is basically quiet or a lot quieter now in Iran, and even at its peak, it was never the majority of the people, a very loud minority. But even so, they continue to try to spark it, to make sure they keep it going.
Right.
And so the goal, of course, is to overthrow the government as it always has been.
First of all, Najim, so you see this continuing to light the fire and to throw gasoline over something that at this point has even become somewhat farcical in terms of what is not happening and the exaggeration that's taking place. But they're continuing. As Marzi Hashemi there says, this has been very persistent, and it's been coming at Iran. It's almost as if Iran is under assault. There's got to be some kind of, I don't want to say a war room, but a thinking room of some kind that's directing what's happening in a sense. Or maybe it's in conjunction. Iranian intelligence ministries have come out and said that the U.S., the U.K., and Israeli Mossad is behind this, of course, with the aid of Saudi Arabia. Are we looking at them working in concert, trying to, or doing what they're doing, especially through their media, and of course through other actions that involve either supporting some terrorist groups, as we have noted, and also the flow of weapons, for example?
Yes, I mean, it's very obvious that there is, you know, think tanks, there is intelligence involved, There's politicians involved, organizations, you know, and they're putting pressure on different governments and regimes in the world to put maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic of Iran and to try to exploit the situation and destabilization that's going on in Iran. They're trying in any kind of way. We see here on social media how they censor all kind of pages that kind of support the Islamic Republic of Iran. They close them down. Even TikTok, the one that was the most tolerant one and the one that gave more accessibility for people to speak out about things, now even that one has been infiltrated and been censoring and closing down accounts. Well, it's a very big project. I think it's a grand project. They're working very heavily on this. There's a lot of different players involved in this. And this is, I think, their last cards, you know, because they failed miserably in all different dimensions, and now they're trying this situation. Especially, they feel kind of happy and encouraged more because they have some Iranians that live in the West that are unfortunately deceived, a lot of them, or some of them are part of terrorist organizations, such as the MKO. They call themselves Mujahideen al-Khalq. They're the Munafiqeen al-Khalq, the hypocrites. And unfortunately, they're hosted, you know, primarily in France, the country now that's trying to silence Press TV. They're hosting this Maryam Rajavi hypocrite that is a part of a terrorist organization that has committed so many terrorist attacks inside Iran, has killed so many righteous people and patriotic people inside Iran. They have so much blood on their hands, and they don't prosecute these people. No, they host them, and they give them security, and they give them social media platforms, and they empower them, and they retweet their tweets and so on, different politicians inside France. I think this is a very, very big war on Iran, especially because Iran has claimed sovereignty and it's a strong power in the region of West Asia. They're also a big threat to the Israeli regime that is the main, base and regime that is supporting the colonial powers and the control of that area. So, it's an ongoing battle, and I think that they cannot in any way, make Iran weaker or have them to become, deterred. Sure. They're undeterred, I think.
Very well. I'm going to test you on a quote and see if you can come up with who has said this. And this person has said, it is completely unacceptable that people were having their lives disrupted by a selfish minority who joined illegal protests.
Uh-huh. So who said that? You tell me.
This is the UK Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. Okay. So, and he's not the only one who has said this,
right,
by the way.
Of course. That's why it was hard to guess which one, as a matter of fact.
Well, I'm trying to make my point here. So here you have it. I mean, I think the UK is on the verge of actually deploying their army out on the streets because there's some strikes that are going
exactly.
on. I think. So there you have that point of view and that, right. and that I guess, approach. And we have seen the riots. We have seen what has happened. We have unfortunately seen very gruesome deaths that have happened, members of besieged that I know, one of them with the throat being slit, and that's terrible.
But here we are, and then
you have Eutelsat, owned by France, coming out saying...
Right,
you know,
can I just jump in with what you just said? I mean, being an American, and of course you were in the States for many, many years, and we know, imagine like a couple of police officers, or security officials, as we call them here, were killed during riots, what would the U.S. do? I remember when I was right here in the studio and covering the situation of Mike Brown years ago in Ferguson. It's a small town. I went there. I did a documentary later on. Very small town. They had tanks on the streets. Tanks on the streets. Okay? So, I mean, it's so hypocritical when we look at these Western regimes and what they're saying. We see with the U.S. and their situation continually deteriorating. We're talking about systemic police violence. We look at the U.K. and the situation, like you're talking about, they're ready to deploy military right now on individuals. And we see France and the yellow vests and the way they have cracked down and this continuation deterioration of life, and people are complaining and how they crack down. The hypocrisy is unbelievable. And here Press TV going against all of these very well-funded regimes and back their television stations, this one voice, they can't even tolerate us just being on the satellite, or they can't tolerate us having, PressTV.com. So what does that say about democracy, as they call it? You know, this is actually exposing the reality of these Western regimes and what they say they stand for and the reality.
Sure. Well, first on Najim, I don't know which one's worse, when you have a satellite operator taking off a channel of its satellite broadcast, or when you take down a domain. I mean, when PressTV.com was taken down and somehow the FBI was involved there, that is an act of war in a sense, because it's a whole domain. It was the whole website of PressTV. Interestingly, one of the reasons that came up for that is the fact that it wasn't for the content, based on this one particular source that said this was because, the source said this, that it's under the control of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC. But it wasn't for content. My point being that if it wasn't for content, then what was the U.S. after when it did this? Only because of its association, which is remains to be seen if there's any, which there may be, to the IRGC, but still not enough to take down a whole website.
I mean, they're going to find any type of way to fabricate things and justify them and find excuses to push through their agenda. And, you know, they have, you know, always made unjust laws. You know, it's all working based on their interests. You know what I mean? They care about human rights. It's all selective, you know. They don't care about the human rights in Palestine. They don't care about the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and that's Yemen. They're supporting Saudi Arabia. They're not imposing any sanctions. The Saudi regime's channels are all broadcasting 24/7 without any problems, not interrupted in any kind of way. And they're using their satellites as well, the Western satellites. And they're also promoting Wahhabism, you know, takfirism, obviously, like sectarian hate and things like this. They're supporting also, these Iranian opposition channels that are lying most of the time and spreading, you know, false rumors, and also empowering more anarchy inside Iran. And they're not being sanctioned. So it's all a matter of their benefits and interests and their agenda. And their agenda is very, very sinister. It's very evil. It's not for stabilization. It's not for justice. It's not for caring about the Iranian nation. If they cared about the Iranian nation, they would first pull off the sanctions, especially when the COVID was spreading at the highest level inside Iran and people were dying. And they were, you know, imposing these strict, harsh sanctions. And why didn't the West at that time, France, put their head up and say, no, we're here to support the Iranian people, and, you know, while they're suffering during this COVID time and this crisis and this, it's unbelievable, like, how these people are playing their game. But I think it's just exposing their true faces. Like I said, we got to keep unmasking, taking these masks off, and slowly they will feel shameful somehow. Sure. Because the nations are waking up. The nations are waking up. The people are waking up.
Right. Well, PressTV is not the only channel that the West has targeted. We can talk about how RT also has been targeted in a vast scale.
Yeah.
Especially when it started back in, I forget the year, when they had to list as a foreign agent.
Right.
Inside the U.S.
Right.
We know CCTV has also been that way. So if they're opposition to the West, in particular the U.S., you're going to get your TV channel shut down?
That's basically it. Not just a TV channel. I mean, of course, we also know the social media and what happened. And we saw a primary example we'll continue to see, but we go back to January 3rd, 2019. And of course, with the assassination of General Soleimani, and we saw people trying to do hashtags and what happened, that their accounts were basically frozen, they were not allowed. There is no freedom of speech in that sense. If you want to question on the top echelons of what is happening, and especially if you're in Iran or in Russia or in some of the other countries that are fighting against the hegemon, they can easily shut you down if they want to. And I think that this is an encouragement for the resistance, basically, to concentrate on creating our own, whether with our own satellites. And of course, we know that Iran is working on that. And I think that we have to work very, very diligently to try to make sure that we have to depend on ourselves and not on them at all.
Okay. First of all, Najim, in closing here, we're looking at some of the issues that rubs the West the wrong way, particularly the U.S., Israel. Of course, I'd like to find out from you, if you can give us maybe the top three that comes to your mind in order of importance of how it has forced the West, the U.S., and satellite operators or what have you to act out as they have against, Iranian media channels, in particular Press TV.
I think one of them would be, speaking the truth, exposing the evil powers and giving a chance to the journalists and the activists in the world to speak out against these and promote this on their site and their social media platforms and so on and on their media channel, Press TV. I think that's one that's really hurting them. And I think that is the Islamic Republic of Iran's sovereignty and inner strength and self-building and self-sufficient system. I think that's also hurting them. And then I would say, third of all, obviously their military strength and the threat against the Zionist war criminal regime that's occupying Palestine. Okay. And this is what's really hurting them and damaging them, yes.
Very well. Same question to you. Top three items you think that's on their list in terms of targeting Press TV?
Well, I think, first of all, showing the truth about Iran, reflecting reality of the Islamic Republic, because all the other channels, or so many of the other channels, especially the Western channels, are continually demonizing Iran and Iranians. So whether we're talking about a light show like Iran itself that would show the various sites inside of the country, or we're talking about other programs and showing the reality in Iran and the news, of course, I think that's number one, actually. And also the resistance front in general, the reality of what happens when we're talking about Hezbollah, when we're talking about what's happening in Yemen, even when we're talking about Iraq and what is happening. I think one of the more important ones, as you know, we remember the unfortunate several Gaza wars, Israeli onslaught on Gaza, and our rolling coverage. We gave it all we had.
Yes,
we continually covered every second of what was going on. And so this was really major. This mm-hmm. was really major, penetrating that basic front that they have in trying to control information. Number one, it's Iran. Number two, it's the resistance itself. And three, of course, it's the situation dealing with Palestine and Gaza.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you so much for that.
I just want to add one thing, if you don't mind.
Sure. First thought, Najim, quickly.
I just want to add one thing. Yeah, yes, quickly. Let's not forget what they did to Marzia Hashemi. That's a strong voice and a vocal voice for Press TV that's always been powerful and never deterred. And they arrested her in the U.S. and they tried to humiliate her and they tried to have her silenced. And she's back up speaking out. She's not, pulling back in any way. You can see right now in the interview, she's not scared of them. She's standing up. And this is what we need. We need more voices like this. We need more revolutionary people. And, we cannot, be submissive even if we are attacked or defamed. Not too long ago, the same thing happened to me. They tried to defame me, arrest me for opposing and speaking. They manipulated the issue, and they closed down my social media accounts as well. I think
right.
The police were involved in pushing, some pressure against social media like Instagram and so on. But,
okay.
I'm not going to stop fighting for the oppressed people.
Good for you. Exactly. Thank you so much for that. Farrell Sanajim speaking there, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights from Toronto. Thank you. Marzi, thank you. It's good to see you. Marzi Hashemi, host of the Press TV's Hidden Files.
Pleasure.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tavway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, believing in God. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of belief in God in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that to be a Muslim and to have an Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to believe in the principles of Islam, since we are following the religion of Islam. And the first belief that we need to have is believing God, which is monotheism in the Islam. And we know that even in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said about all the religions that all the Prophet from Adam alayhi salam till Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, they all came with one religion which was monotheism. But obviously the rules and the laws were different according to the time. So it is necessary for a Muslim to believe in God, to worship one God, which is monotheism. Therefore, having an Islamic lifestyle means that we believe in one God, we are monotheists, and we worship one God who is the most powerful, who is almighty, who is beneficent, who is merciful. These are the characteristics of God which we need to believe. And the most important thing is that He is just. We must believe that He is just and He has created us because of His just, and He wants us to have justice in our life. Therefore, it is necessary that a believer believes truly in the God. And therefore, if he does so, he can have a good Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of belief in God in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that it is necessary to believe in God, and obviously when we are believing in God, we know that He is the creator of all. So once a person in the Islamic lifestyle believes that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah Almighty is the creator, and He has created us through His justice, therefore our whole life will be spent worshipping Him. As we say in the prayers as well, that إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. Only You we worship, and only You, from You we seek help. Now, the question is that when we say only You we worship, are we really worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala all the time during the day or not? Now, the answer is that we can worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala during the day. Even every single moment of our life can be spent in worshipping the Allah Almighty if we spend our life according to the teachings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If we spend our life according to the teachings of the Quran that we have. Therefore, it is necessary that we align our daily routine or the practices that we have with the teachings of Islam. For example, if Islam says to be good with your neighbors, we need to be good. If it says pray 5-time prayers, we have to pray. If Islam says you need to have the veil or hijab, we need to have the hijab. If Islam says earn halal, we should have earning halal earnings. So all these things that are said in the Islam, if we are living according to that, then we are spending every single moment of our life in worshiping God. And the most important thing is, before you perform anything, just remember whether God is happy with this or not. If He's happy of what I'm doing, then obviously I'm spending my life in order to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A Church of England disciplinary tribunal for Reverend Stephen Sizer, one of the leading figures in the debunking of Christian Zionism. The purpose of the tribunal, to hear 11 anti-Semitism accusations against him. His main accuser, the Board of Deputies of British Jews. The accusations against him, sharing a platform with Holocaust deniers while attending peace conferences in the Middle East, and sharing on social media articles containing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories from other websites. The 68-year-old priest declined to comment after the hearing, but people close to him say he's been crucified for criticizing Israel.
Those Jews like me and many others who worked with Dr. Sizer for many years know for sure that he's the last person on this earth you could call an anti-Semite or racist. He is the kindest, very careful person, and he's anything but the opposite of anti-Semite. He is against what Israel is doing, so am I, and so are many Jews in this country and across the world.
The problem arises from the controversial International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of Israel with hatred of Jews.
Now is the time the Church of England really needs to stop on the IHRA. You can't come out and say they have reservations with the IHRA and then still use the same definition. This makes no sense in any shape or form and needs to be addressed seriously. It's basically like saying, we agree that this is wrong, but we're still going to go ahead with it because we don't really care whether it offends Muslims or whether it upsets Muslims.
Today's hearing cleared the Reverend of 7 of the 11 allegations against him.
A final hearing is scheduled for next month. People close to Stephen Sizer say that this whole thing was a witch hunt that has taken its toll on the Reverend, on his family, and the people who support him and the Palestinian cause. Saeed Puraza, London.
EU leaders are furious with Hungary for blocking an 18 billion euro financial aid package for Ukraine, the first tranche of which is due to be released to Kiev next month. Finance ministers from the 27-nation bloc came together on Tuesday to try and resolve the impasse, but the meeting ended in failure.
Ukraine is a country at war. It desperately needs our support, and we just cannot allow one member state delay and derail this EU financial support.
This debacle follows a European Commission proposal last week to freeze 7.5 billion euro in funding to Hungary from the EU budget amid claims that Budapest is not meeting the bloc's rule of law standards. Aside from Ukraine, EU finance ministers have major problems closer to home. The energy crisis in the EU, resulting from sanctions against Russia, is getting worse by the day. The European Commission warns of economic disaster if EU nations continue to subsidise high energy costs in an ad hoc emergency fashion.
That is why we encourage member states to improve the targeting of this measure, and we have recommended replacing broad-based priced measure with a cost-efficient two-tier energy pricing system.
Out of control, energy prices are making the cost of living crisis in the EU unbearable for households and businesses. Eurozone inflation is at 10%. The European Central Bank is aggressively increasing interest rates to try and tackle the problem. Economists warn forcing inflation down too quickly can also be dangerous.
Of course, if you have a persistent drop in prices, people might think, well, I'm not going to buy now. I'm not going to spend now because prices will come down. So I'm going to stay with my money in the pockets and wait for later. And of course, you don't have economic activity.
Croatia will become the 20th member of the Eurozone next month. EU finance ministers say Zagreb will be able to enjoy all the benefits. However, the euro has a troubled history, and so it's clear Croatia will also be exposed to potential risks during these incredibly uncertain economic times. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States House of Representatives has announced an investigation into allegations of a secret deal to boost oil production between the administration of President Joe Biden and Saudi Arabia. Biden is accused of trying to arrange a deal with Riyadh to increase oil production ahead of the U.S. midterm elections last month. Conservative lawmakers say that could represent election manipulation. It's the first official probe announced since the Republicans won control of the House of Representatives. Many other controversial hearings are expected to follow, such as on the handling of the coronavirus, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, corruption allegations involving Biden's son, and others. Just as Democrats forced questionable investigations over the past 2 years, a now divided Congress will likely be preoccupied with partisan issues of often questionable importance to the average person.
In the end of neoliberalism, we're in a kind of age of disorder. And this is kind of the show that is being played out, is that people are just going to be disillusioned from politics entirely. And that's going to open up the potential of polarization, like wider polarization.
Pro-Trump representatives in the House have already introduced articles of impeachment against Biden over the family-related corruption allegations. Many are skeptical that Congress will devote enough time to meeting the widespread economic problems caused by record inflation and Western belligerence towards Russia, China, Iran, and others.
Now, let's still push through the agenda that's necessary to to maintain the super rich are super rich and that no relief for the working class. And once again, points to the need for the urgency for the foundation for a new party and also ultimately a new system.
An irony is that Riyadh and the OPEC Plus oil production group ultimately ignored Biden's demands for more oil and instead voted to cut production. And despite the cuts, last month Biden still awarded Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman immunity for all cases involving the infamous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Biden campaigned on holding bin Salman accountable, and his backtracking drew global condemnation. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
More than 1 year after the Taliban returned to power, a Gallup survey has found that almost all Afghans, or 98%, rate their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. The survey shows that the situation is getting worse for Afghans, and they have fully lost hope that their future will be any better.
Absolutely, people are suffering, especially from joblessness, poverty, insecurity, and little access to their basic rights. Their life conditions were grim even before the Taliban takeover, but recently people's hardships have become even worse. Still, we are not sure what the future holds for us.
Currently, Afghan girls and women are dealing with many difficulties, especially their struggle to get education or a job to make ends meet. Poverty has not only affected men, but also the well-being of Afghan women and children. Being relatively barred from public places makes us further desperate.
According to the survey, 9 in 10 Afghans say they find it very difficult to make ends meet. 92% of the respondents say they think it is a bad time to find a job, while 86% say they have been unable to buy themselves food.
Making ends meet has become very difficult. We need to skip some meals to survive. The arrival of the cold season is adding to the people's suffering. With no job and relief assistance, you can imagine how disastrous people's lives can become.
I'm the sole breadwinner of my 8-member family. Sometimes I can put food on the table, but sometimes we go to bed hungry. The situation is so difficult that sometimes we can't even buy ourselves some oil. Having heating or other necessities is becoming almost impossible.
The Gallup survey also reveals that the unpopularity of the American leadership has risen to a record 84% among Afghans. Meanwhile, the poll shows more and more Afghans are looking favorably towards Iran, as the neighboring country's popularity is on the rise. Afghanistan is rated as the most suffering and unhappiest country in the world. Many here believe the current situation is a direct result of the U.S. occupation and war in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Russian prisoners of war being executed by Ukrainian soldiers. Multiple videos have been released on Ukrainian Telegram channels. The most recent shows 11 Russian soldiers shot in the head after being detained. While both sides accuse each other of war crimes, Kiev is openly flaunting the crimes committed at the hands of its troops. At a press conference in Lugansk, a Russian soldier, Dmitry, recounts what happened when he was captured on the front line.
They ordered me to lie down, hands behind my back. One of them came up to me and hit my back with the handle of his machine gun. They put a bag on my head and waited for their commanders. In some time, the commander came, took the bag off my head, took me by the throat and started to cut my left hand with a knife. It's still functioning badly. He hit me in the teeth. And afterwards, when they took my machine gun from the vehicle, he asked if it was charged. I answered that it wasn't. He took the cartridge from it, clicked it, pointed at my leg and clicked. Nothing happened, because it was really not charged. He said I was lucky.
On the screen, gruesome images. Russian authorities say they have evidence of torture and a lack of provision of basic medical care, leading to unnecessary death.
Now, many of these atrocities are being ignored by media outlets in NATO countries, but Russian journalists, of course, are here transmitting to a Russian audience, which means large parts of the Russian population are becoming increasingly angry at Ukraine and its NATO backers for atrocities committed against Russian soldiers.
The videos that show Russian prisoners of war being essentially murdered after they've surrendered have been posted by Ukrainian soldiers. These are videos taken by Ukrainian soldiers and then posted on the internet, essentially as a point of pride, in the belief that they are somehow or another frightening or horrifying the Russians, who knows. But I also think there's another sinister dimension to this. I think there's an interest in Ukraine, particularly in Kiev or Kyiv, to ensure that there can be no negotiated settlement between Ukraine and Russia, not so much because of people in Kiev that might be willing to talk, but I think there's growing fear that Washington will ultimately abandon them.
As Russia continues to destroy energy infrastructure and kill Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines in Donbass, and as Ukraine continues to shell civilians in Donetsk and release videos of its war crimes, anger is reaching new heights on both sides, making peace an even more distant prospect. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on the impact of the continued Saudi siege on thalassemia patients. Those suffering from this disease need to get blood transfusions every 3 weeks and must stay on medication for life.
Our main concern is the lack of medicines for thalassemia patients. These medicines, if available, are very expensive in addition to the lack of necessary medical examinations. We have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni Health Ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdulatif Lwashali, Sana'a.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including centre-left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance in with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
Planned nationwide strikes were supposed to start on Monday across Iran, based on social media posts that have been calling for business owners to roll down their shutters for 3 days. A quick stroll on the streets of Tehran, however, shows that all the fuss is limited to the virtual world.
Life goes on as normal here in this district. I think social media exaggerates the problems. From what I saw today, no one is paying attention to the calls for a strike.
The country has been gripped by street violence for 10 weeks now, with anti-government protests claiming the lives of civilians and security forces. Now, the same protesters have called for a three-day strike, marking the anniversary of the National Student Day in the country.
Student Day belongs to the Islamic Revolution and is a manifestation of the repression exercised by the former Pahlavi regime against our people. So it can't be used to protest against the Islamic establishment. I'm certain that all of the plots hatched to cause trouble to our country are doomed to failure.
Videos circulating on social media show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed. However, people say some shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism by protesters.
Everyone is busy with their businesses today. There are some shops which have been closed, but the majority of them fear possible damage by protesters.
The Islamic Republic says what's happening on social media is not a true reflection of what's actually going on the ground. Over the past days, Iranian officials have been calling for a national dialogue to, quote, stop the enemy from fishing in troubled waters. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Dear sisters and brothers from all around the world, I hope you're doing well. This is a new episode of Back to Reality, and I'm very happy to be here as your host. Actually, you're listening to Asma. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Sister Zainab. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Thank you for having me here with you. That's my pleasure to be here with your listeners.
Thank you for being here. Thank you. Thank you, both of you, for coming. And this is actually a pleasure for me to be here with you. And it's such an enjoyable session with you too. Well, now before we start, just give us a very brief introduction about your background.
Actually, I'm Bita, and I'm studying medicine at one of the universities of Tehran.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in that sort of topics that we were discussing in our radio, and that's my pleasure again that I'm here with you.
I am from Kashmir, the Indian administrated Kashmir, and I am done with master's in linguistics. I am studying in seminary school right now, and I have been working as TV anchor from past 8 years.
So, very nice. It's a pleasure to have you in here. Well, as for today, we are going to discuss something that might sound very much depressing. But it is the truth. There is no way to ignore death, because one day, or I don't know, 1 hour, there would be this world without me. Death is something pretty much actual, and there is no way to ignore it. We all are going to face it one day. It might sound depressing, but I guess to some points it would be a sign of hope as well. Now, can you relate to the hope part?
Yeah, of course. You know,
Sister Bita can.
Everyone, I start from my own experience. Yeah. As you know, in our ID cards, there is a part for your death, which, you know, there are days, the reason of your death, and so on. Whenever I actually open my ID card and I open that page of my death, I have a special feeling. You know, you cannot imagine what feeling is, but it is so special that you are seeing the page that will someday will be filled with the, you know, identification and the information of your death. And that is always touching for me. I don't know why. And but this feeling
it's
is not that much
depressing. It's awkward and depressing and sad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not always the absolute depression when I see that page, you know?
Really?
It's like, okay, I'm not dead yet. And this is the hope that you were talking about, I think. You know? And I think one blessing that we all have, the human being has, is that we don't know the date of our death. And this is a blessing. Of course it is. Because I think if every single one of us knew the date of her or his death, it would be disastrous. You know, you didn't have any hope.
Yeah, you see, there were some movies. I don't know if you have watched or not, but there are plenty of them, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
In which there is a woman, or whatever, the hero of the movie or the hero of the book, the novel, is getting some special intuitions, some special blessing, or let me say just a curse, has been given to them. And then they suddenly can understand the date of death of other people. And then there comes a day when they understand the date of their own death. That's actually a disaster. That's very difficult to bear. And now I would like to hear Sister Zainab's idea about that, which is actually telling me with her face, but now you cannot see it. So now she's so sad. Okay.
Well, I'm so scared. Well,
now, sister, why death is so scary?
To some, it's scary. I don't have firm faith. Like
to most, I guess it's scary.
Sister, Bita said that I have a special feeling. I love, like she loves to get the certificate of death. But she said I love to see that page filled. She loves to get the certificate. But I have always like worked because I am studying. I don't want to get the certificate. I want to work after getting the certificate. So what would I do after getting the certificate? First of all, I want to get it into my hands. So I'll be done. I'll be over.
Yeah.
It's scary because most of us think it's the end.
Yeah, that's very true.
We in India or the Urdu language use the word intikal for death, which means transfer.
That is more accurate.
Yeah, which is more accurate for death.
Yeah.
It's not the end.
It's the precise thing that happens.
Exactly. But no one believes that it's not the end. Those who very firmly believe that I'm gone, that means I am gone. And there's going to be no me after me. There's no transfer or I don't know. They don't have very firm
now,
belief in that.
Your sentence,
that's what makes it scary.
Just what you said. There is no me then after this. Let's keep it there. Go for a short break and we'll be back with the rest of the topic. So thank you, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. Well, we are discussing death in Back to Reality, and we have got some ideas in here. Well, death is depressing. Death is very much awkward. I guess because we do not have any idea about what's going on in the next step.
Yes, because maybe we are less literate towards that thing, that there is a world after this world, that there's going to be a transfer happening. I remember a day in my seminary school, our teacher told us that today we are going to talk about death, and everyone was, teacher, please change the topic, we don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And she was like, after this session, I promise you, you will love death. So
how
you won't
come?
Be, you won't be scared anymore. Then people say like, well then we got to the concept that it's a transfer, all right. So we are not aware of this transfer. It's a transfer into another world. Your soul lives, it's just your body that dies. So again, the girls in the class were like, because women are so much attached to their body.
Yeah.
So they're like, oh, we still are scared.
Exactly.
I think, you know, only knowing about the afterlife is not enough, you know, to not have the fear of death.
Of course.
I think the most important part is the connection you have with this world. You have to lower this connection. You know what I'm telling you? For example,
attachment.
Yeah,
to me.
Exactly. Attachment is a better and nicer word. You know, you are that much attached to whatever you have in this world.
Exactly.
Money. Yeah. I don't know. Success. Opportunity. Job.
Job.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, this materialistic
family,
love.
Family.
Family.
Yeah, even family, which is materialistic even in some points. And these all will make you somehow really somehow overconnected to this world.
Yeah.
And this is a problem, I think, that we are frightened from death.
Yeah, sister, I do believe in that, you know. Sometimes I think if I was a person living on a far-fetched island, far away from people, not doing anything, and just was, you know, enjoying nature and then living a happy life all alone with the, you know, trees and the seas and whatever, I would have maybe felt scared of death even lesser than exactly. right now. Because at that time, then I would have had no attachment to this world, you know? Mm. The more you grow in having attachment, the more your list of attachments is growing, the more scared you're going to be. Because even when I sleep at night, I would say, okay, I have this that must be done. I have that must be done. I have plenty much of responsibilities. I have a family to feed. I have whatever. And a lot of things, you know, the list is increasing as you just count. Then you come to think, okay, what if I die?
Yeah.
You know, when you become sick, that moment comes
exactly.
to you.
Exactly. And everything seems somehow numb and meaningless. Yeah. And I hate that feeling. But I think this